This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 73. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
I'm Rob.
We're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week?
I'm just hanging out, man. I'm getting over the fact that I've had more contractors flake on me in the past 2 weeks than I have in the past 6 months. It's been such a downer couple of weeks. And it's just, I think it's just one of those things that happens every once in a while. Just people have like, well, sometimes there's a valid reason and sometimes there's not. But I think I joked with you over email that outsourcing never, ever works, which obviously we don't believe at all. And actually a couple of them like disappeared or have stopped emailing or have emailed and said like, oh, I'm booked and I have to back out. Now, luckily, a couple of them did get back in touch and were like, oh, no, I'm going to go through with it. And we talked again and figured it out. So feeling better about it. But it was a dark time for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the one thing that I don't necessarily like is the fact that, you know, because it is a contractor, and typically you're relying on email or non-real-time communications to get in touch with them, and you basically just send your message off into oblivion and you hope that they got it, and if they did get it, then hopefully they, you know, respond to it in some reasonable amount of time, and you just don't have any visibility there, so you don't know if they read the message or not, or whether they got it, or, you know, you're basically just sitting there waiting. And I think that's probably the worst part, because you're trying to move other things along and you don't want to have to pay attention to it, but you still kind of have to.
Right. And then you're like, well, this task is maybe, you know, a 10-hour task, or maybe it's a 40-hour task. And you have to sit there and weigh, like, should I just suck it up and do this? You know, kind of pull a long night and kill a whole day and do it so I'm not waiting? Because it could be a week or two until I hear back or until this person has time to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's been the real dilemma the whole time, is it's like, all right, now 3 or 4 weeks have passed. That task still isn't done. Is it time for me to just, you know, suck it up and make it happen? So this is the downside, I guess, of outsourcing. And luckily, it doesn't happen to me very much. So it's just funny that it all kind of happened at one time.
Yeah, I've got the same problem right now. I've got a contractor who's converting some software for me, and I haven't heard anything in probably 4 or 5 days. So I emailed a day or two ago, and I haven't heard anything yet. So
I've actually really found Boomerang is helpful for this, because mm-hmm. then I'm able to email and say, if they don't reply, ping me in 2 days so that at least I can get back to them again. Because otherwise, I forget about it. And then a week later, I remember, and I'm like pissed off. You know,
right.
I'm like, God, that thing still isn't done. I forgot about that.
No, I have that set up. It's just, yeah, I know. You know, it's just in the back of my mind. I know that that thing's going to come back around in the next couple of days. And I got to say, okay, well, I haven't heard from you in another 4 days. So what's going on?
Hey, you had brought up business taxes filing by March 15th. And I was like, oh, yeah, not for me. I don't need that. And then my accountant emails and he's like, hey, I just filed an extension for you. And I was like, what? Isn't that hilarious? I was like, for what? And he's like, it's all of your Numa Group taxes. So apropos, you had hit it on the head last time. Then you spent just a couple hours on your taxes and you were all done?
No, I sent it off to my CPA, and it took, I'd say probably a week and a half of going back and forth with him. Just there were a few transactions here and there that really threw my numbers out of whack. So things were off like 15,000 in one direction and off 17 in the other direction. And they were still close, but they were just off by a little bit. And, you know, accountants don't like numbers when they don't add up. But, I got through it. It wasn't that bad. I mean, my taxes have already been filed.
I had a couple other things. I was listening back to, I think it was last week's episode, and I had heard since then about some other low cost per click ad networks. We'd mentioned ad networks last week for driving traffic to landing pages. There's a couple. One is called advertise.com. One is pulse360.com. And the third is adbrite.com. And so we'll link them up in the show notes, but they're like lower quality traffic, but you can get some crazy cheap, like nickel clicks from AdBrite and the others. So definitely something for folks to check out. And the nice part is they are broader than just techies. You know, they don't focus on designers and developers. I mean, you can actually get traffic targeting other things.
That's really cool. I'll have to check those out. So the only other thing I've been working on aside from taxes is talking to a lot of the MicroConf sponsors. I mean, we're down, getting close to the wire. We've got, 6 weeks left, 7 weeks left? And just trying to finalize things with a lot of the sponsors. And for anyone who's interested, we got a lot of good sponsors this year. Again, we've got Balsamic, BidSketch, UsabilityTest, KissMetrics, Software Promotions, WP Engine, which I think you're an investor of. And right. then MailChimp, Redgate Software, User Voice, Kit Apps, and Constant Contact. So pretty good so far. And, you know, we'll probably have a few more that sign on over the next couple of weeks. And we may need to draw a line in the sand and just say, you know, we're not really accepting any more at this point. But so far, things are going pretty good.
Nice. I listened to TechZing, the most recent episode, and they were talking about our review competition. And so I had realized that I had never reviewed the TechZing podcast. So I logged into iTunes and gave them a 5-star. You know, you don't actually need to do a full comment review where you actually write stuff. You can just click on the stars. It's pretty easy to go into iTunes, search for startups. And we are currently ahead in the competition. I think the last thing for me is I'd mentioned last week that I was disappointed with the way that Hittail had been going. Basically, that I had relaunched it about 2 months ago with a new design. And then I had some goals for where I wanted revenue and income and all that to be. And I had not hit anywhere near them. And I realized a couple things. One, I was actually talking to my wife about it and said, you know, I have friends, some are in mastermind groups and others are just colleagues, and I'm talking to them about their progress and I'm feeling like, you know, I'm not able to move as quickly as them. And she asked me, like, what else do they do? And I was like, well, what do you mean? And she's like, well, do they just run an app like Hittail? And I said, yeah. And she said, but you do other stuff, right? You're running a conference and you have your blog and you have your book. We have the academy. We have the podcast. I have an email newsletter. Like, we just started talking through it all. And I realized, like, wow, it's stupid that I hadn't thought about that. But my week is so divided among these things that I really haven't been able to focus anywhere near the amount of just pure unadulterated hours that I should be if I want to hit these goals that I've set. So in actuality, my disappointment is probably unjustified because I basically set an almost unachievable goal for myself, I've realized over the past couple of days. And I was pretty down about it, you know, over the past couple of weeks. And then I've been coming out of it over the past 2 or 3 days, realizing like what I need to do is adjust my goals, or I need to get rid of everything else, you know, not do that other stuff. And I don't want to do that. I enjoy the variety. So I've taken a more realistic view of the revenue goals that I have for Hittail, and I'm actually feeling mentally just way better about it.
Oh, cool. Today's episode is going to be about how to deal with service outages. And given our previous discussions about how things have gone with the Academy, how we've encountered some of the downtime that we have, I mean, obviously, through no fault of our own, we really just can't control when a server decides to die or a RAID controller goes. But what we can control is how we deal with the situation afterwards and how we can let people know how things are going. And this also came about because somebody had emailed in a comment to questions@startupsforrestos.com and said, I'd like to hear you guys talk about the Azure outage and related business issues. Seeing as this would affect Audit Shark, I'm thinking it would be good to discuss the downsides of relying on specific cloud resources like this or Amazon with their latest big outage. Talking points I think would be good to hear about are there ways to mitigate this and have redundant systems, but a micropreneur also has to weigh the costs of time and effort related to these. Is it really worth it for most micropreneurs to do what it would take to protect themselves from this? Even if you're not using a service like this, significant outages can happen. What are some good ways to make things right with your customers? The importance of keeping customers in the loop during outages and letting them know, not just that you're aware, but what you're doing to fix things, is something that is constantly overlooked by companies, even though letting folks know these things can help them to empathize with you and not be all pissed off about the site being down. Thanks for the great show, Kay. So between the Academy going down and then getting this email, it really made me stop and think, are we doing the right things? And I think that we definitely have some room for improvement. And so what I did was I sat down and I thought about the things you should be doing. And I realized that we're not doing nearly enough, I don't think. So we'll talk about it. And then afterwards, I think that we're going to go and actually implement some of these because I think we've just neglected it. We haven't really looked at that stuff. You know, we haven't really had to deal with downtime either.
Right. Yeah, that's a thing. I mean, to give folks, you know, a lot of people probably don't know what we're talking about with the Academy going down. Basically, the Academy is hosted on DreamHost, and it has been since it launched 3 years ago. And typically, DreamHost, it has maybe one or two outages a year, like a typical web host, you know. They might be a six-hour outage, or sometimes there were 15-hour outages or something, but which sucks at the time, but for the price and for what they allow you to have, it's totally worth it since, you know, I don't run any mission-critical systems on that. Now, in the past, maybe 40 days, I think the Academy has had 4 or 5 outages, and DreamHost specifically is having some issues with the server. It's the hardware that my VPS runs on, and so that's been the headache of it. Now, there hasn't, knock on wood, there hasn't been an outage now in about 2 weeks, and they were coming like every 5 days, right? And it was always something different. It was like the RAID controller, or one time it was the hard drive. And
it was a router at one point, I think, too.
Router, yep. And they would move it, and then they'd restore from backup, and it would take, you know, one of them was like a 48-hour outage, which is just inexcusable, right, from any standpoint. Even a non-mission critical thing like the Academy, that sucks. So with that said, we had several bouts of downtime. We're hoping we're through it, but we are in the process of moving to a new web host that's going to be faster and hopefully have better uptime. But that is part of the impetus for this episode.
So this episode is going to concentrate largely on things that are outside of your control, because planned outages and planned upgrades or downtime are a lot easier to manage, because people generally realize that upgrades need to take place. And although they're sometimes a little bit inconvenient, it's also the cost of doing business with a service provider that, you know, gives you these services online. So typically those types of outages, you know about them in advance, you can kind of plan around them. And if they let you know, oh, we're going to be down between the hours of 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. on Sunday morning, you typically don't care. But what's not easy to deal with is these extended outages where the customer doesn't know that it's coming and it is going to impact their business. Now, with the Academy, we're not providing business critical functions, but at the same time, there's a lot of online services out there that do. Take, for example, 37 Signals. I mean, they've got, I would imagine, a pretty large server farm to run all of the stuff that they do. And if Basecamp goes down for a day, I can't even begin to imagine the number of emails that they would get in support just because Basecamp is down. I mean, how many million users do they have on that?
Seriously. I mean, the same thing Joel Spolsky said before they did the Fogbugs on demand, the hosted version of Fogbugs. He said the reason they hadn't done that is because he never felt like they had the infrastructure knowledge and the money to do it the way he wanted to do it. He wanted to have absolute redundant hot backup data centers on opposite ends of the country, because he did not want Fogbugs going down to cause basically millions of dollars in lost productivity, because people use this as a workflow tool. And if, you know, when you learn to rely on it, basically developers would be sitting on their hands. So when they eventually rolled it out, that's what they did. It was like super redundant. So same thing with 37 Signals. I imagine they have a pretty extensive infrastructure going on there.
One of the first things to look at when you have a service that you're offering as a hosted service to your customers is to set up monitoring systems to independently let you know when downtime actually occurs. So you don't really want to be relying on your hosting provider or your co-location facility or anything like that, because I've had, for example, I've relied on that stuff in the past before for a server that I had co-located someplace, and they had all this on-site monitoring and everything else, and my server just stopped responding one day, and I didn't know why, and I was trying to figure it out, and I called them up, and they said, oh yeah, the power is out at the co-location facility. I'm like, well, don't you have diesel backup generators? And they said, well, yeah, but we turned them all off because the cooling system went out. So basically, the cooling system went out. They turned everything off, and including all the servers, so that the place didn't go up in smoke. And relying on those internal controls is not going to save you when that sort of stuff happens. So you really have to have a third party that will let you know about those things. And a couple of tools that I've looked at before, I've used Pingdom. I actually have an account with them. I have a Varello account. I've looked at UptimeMonitor.net. But basically, these tools all do the same kind of thing. They allow you to monitor your sites. And, you know, each system has some different mechanisms to it. But the basic idea is you want to know when things are a problem before your customers find out that it's a problem.
Yeah, this is kind of a big deal. I've actually started doing this with all my sites, and I didn't used to. But what's cool is that you can actually, when you get an email, especially like you said, Varello and Pingdom do, you know, either minute or sub-minute comparisons, and I think you can tell it to wait a couple minutes before emailing, or they automatically do that, because you don't just want there to be some tiny glitch and, you know, to suddenly get an email your site's down. But if it's down for a couple of minutes, you get an instant email. You always know before your web host does. Like, I don't think there's ever been a time where I've emailed my web host, said my stuff's down, and they were like, yeah, we already know. It's always like, oh, we had no idea. And then if they get on it fast and fix it, your customers quite often will never find out. And that is the ideal scenario, right? Is basically fixing the problem before they ever hear about it.
So the second part of building a process for dealing with these types of issues is determining if redundant systems are warranted or necessary. And I think that this depends a lot on your business model, the price point, the expectations from your users. You know, if you have 10 million users, you really need redundancy. There's really no question about it at that point. If you have 10 chances are probably not. So there is that range in there. I think you have to make the judgment call based on the revenue that you're making and how much that downtime can actually cost you. So one of the things that you can do, and there's a few different ways to look at it. One is, you know, how much money are you going to have to refund to customers? What sort of a backlash would you expect to get? And a big one is the number of support emails that you get. Because if you get 100 support emails and you have to spend 2 or 3 hours dealing with them, that's basically 3 hours of support costs. I've seen entrepreneurs who've told me, hey, last quarter I had $50,000 worth of support costs because of this one customer. They email in so often, or they provide a product that they in turn resell, and you know they get emails, so those things get forwarded on to you know this entrepreneur, and those things cost real money. I mean, you may think, oh, it's just an email, but they still cost time. Somebody has to respond to them, and you have to deal with those on an ongoing basis. So a lot of the times, it's just making judgment calls about what works and makes sense for your business. One of the things that comes to mind is Netflix, and one of the first things that Netflix did when they built out their cloud infrastructure was they built this thing called the Chaos Monkey. And you can read about it online. Just search for Chaos Monkey in Netflix and you'll find it. And essentially, it's all about they built this little application that would run in the cloud, and its sole job was to run around to all the other services that were run by Netflix and shut them down, or you know, basically cause problems. And the developers' jobs was to code the application in such a way that it could tolerate failures wherever they may occur. So if the login was failing, for example, go to some sort of a caching system. If you know the streaming was failing, go to a different set of servers for streaming. Or if there's an entire data center crash, be able to go to another data center. Most people don't realize this, but Netflix uses both Azure, Windows Azure, and Amazon to host Netflix, so that if one of those services goes down, they can actually flip over to the other, and most customers don't even know.
And that's right there where you said, you know, there's that balance between having 10 customers and 10 million, and they're at the 10 million. They're in that order of magnitude. So
yeah, they're close to
20 million. Yeah. So it's totally worth it for them, right, to actually have all that money and time invested into that infrastructure and be able to switch over.
It may be just hosted on Amazon.
That makes sense.
But the idea was that they did have it split between multiple data centers so that if one failed, it could go over to the other. And maybe that was the issue. Like they put too much traffic over onto the other Amazon data center. I'm not real sure of that.
Right. I think a second part to this, the way you started this point was talking about determine if redundant systems are warranted or necessary. And I think a big part of that is how many customers you have, your budget. But I also think a part of it is what are your customers doing on your website? If you have a job board, then being down for 6 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, that it does suck. And you know, you probably want to refund some money to your customers, but that's not the end of the world. Like people can come back in a few hours and look for a job or post a job. But when you have something like a workflow tool and a big enterprise is using it, or even a small enterprise, you know, something like Basecamp that's actually holding people up from doing their work, then you're going to have a much bigger problem on. You're going to have people who are more pissed off. And I think Netflix is a unique case where it's like an enterprise is not using it, but consumers do tend to kind of wreak havoc on you, you know, especially if you have 20 million of them. If you're down, you are going to have to deal with that support cost you talked about earlier that I bet is a very real support cost when they have outages. You know, the last thing I wanted to add to this is kind of an aside. Have you ever listened to the podcast, This Developer's Life?
I listened to it a couple of times.
It's really cool. It's Rob Connery and Scott Hanselman. And they basically, it's modeled after This American Life, which is, you know, an NPR podcast. And so This Developer's Life, basically just, they choose a theme and then they do a couple of vignettes and they interview typically software developers. And there's one episode, it's one of the best of the series. The best one I've heard, or one of the best, is called Pressure. And it's about when Stack Overflow went down. And their database got corrupted. And so they interviewed Jeff Atwood and all the people dealing with that. It is really good. If you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend
it. I think that's one of the few episodes that I did catch of it.
They talk about all this stuff about when you're in the moment, and they talk about the Chaos Monkey and all that. So if you want to hear more about this, I recommend folks check it out.
So the next thing that you should do is provide a third-party channel for people to submit issues and make sure they know how to use it. And that's the key piece of this one, is not just providing a third-party channel, but making sure they know how to use it and publicizing it to them. So for example, if you have a website, typically the third-party channel is going to be email. Relying on a contact us page on your website is not going to cut it. You really need to make sure that people know to email you support at whatever your domain is, because otherwise that thing goes down and you know you're kind of post. There's not much you can do about it at that point because they have no way to get to the contact us page because it's not even responding because your site is down. And with that kind of goes separating out your email host from your web host, because if they're both hosted on the same server or in the same set of servers, you could easily take the whole infrastructure down in one shot. So making sure that you separate those up, divide them into, you know, the different levels of responsibility. You know, there are some hosts that I know of who use a third-party hosted status site. So, for example, DreamHost has a, what is it, DreamHostStatus.com. They just have this other site, and they, you know, people know that to go there if DreamHost is having problems for whatever reason. It's pretty rare when I see the DreamHost website itself go down, but I have seen it go down on occasion.
I think one note here, and something as a micropreneur who, you know, doesn't have a lot of infrastructure and doesn't want to set up a bunch of third-party sites, I make sure the support at my domain name always resolves. I have a support at email address for all of my apps. And it's, so to me, it's at least a semi-intuitive way for people to contact me. Even if the website's down, they can always reach us.
So the next item on the list is to commit to fixing ongoing issues, not just patching things up with duct tape. And you need to let users know what happened, how you intend to address these issues in the future, and prevent them from ever happening again. And one of the things that came to mind was very recently I got an email from Windows Azure, and basically it just summarized what had previously happened. There was a disruption on February 29th. They basically just say, we want to let you know, here's our follow-up on this particular disruption. You know, here's our blog post that shares all of our findings, root cause analysis, and here's where they're posted. And then they lay out, these are all the services that were impacted, and, you know, they apologize for it. And then they basically say that they recognize that, you know, this could have some serious impact on their users. And they say they're going to apply credit whether you were affected by this outage or not, and which is kind of nice. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that if you, you know, if you weren't affected by it, then, you know, you don't necessarily need to refund somebody's money for it. But at the same time, if you're not tracking who was affected or you don't have a way to track who's affected, it might be worth the goodwill of just saying, hey, we're going to refund your money for the time that it was down or in excess of the time that was down in order to essentially buy goodwill with your user base.
Yeah, I think this is one thing that we should probably do. We should probably send out an email to all the members of the Academy and let them know. You posted about it in the forums, had conversations. Really, we should just be proactive and email and say, this is what's happened. This is what we're doing, because we are moving to a new host. We're moving to a better, faster, more reliable host. We should let people know that we're doing that so that they at least know that we're aware of it and we're not just sitting on our hands on this one.
This is definitely what I had more in mind when I was going through this list. And I mean, because we do have monitoring set up in terms of redundant systems. We don't really have redundancy, but it's not mission critical. If it's down for a few hours, it's really not that big a deal. The support burden doesn't get too high. I mean, we do get some emails, especially I see some emails to me personally on occasion saying, oh, did you know that the site's down? And I can at least say yes. As we said, we've already got the support at micropreneur.com up and running. People tend to know that they can send an email there and, you know, get support for that or let us know that something's down. But I think that committing to fixing the ongoing issues is really a big thing, and letting people know that what we're doing about it is a big one. And I just don't think we've done that well enough. I've posted in the forums, I've talked to people about it individually through email, but I don't feel like it's been publicized very well. And the other thing that kind of ties into this is that you should have a way to contact your users when you do have an outage, because right now we don't. If our site's down and it's going to be down and we know it, we don't have a way to let them know.
You know, we do. We have an email list that's separate from DreamHost.
Is it?
That we could use, yeah. It notifies people about new lessons, so they could have unsubscribed from it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how many copies can we really have? So that would do a pretty good job. I bet we'd hit most people.
Right. I knew that list was there, but I wasn't sure how accurate it would be.
Mostly accurate. How about that?
But, I mean, just doing something like exporting the list like once a day or something like that would be probably fine. And I think that that would catch the vast majority of people, and we'd be able to let them know, hey, we're having an outage. At least we would let us look into those things, because right now I don't feel like we have a good process or procedure in place for dealing with that stuff.
Yep.
So to follow up on those, if your hosting provider is unable or unwilling to fix some things, you need to go somewhere else. And honestly, that's kind of the point we're at with the Academy, is we've decided to actually move the entire system from one host to another. And we are moving to WP Engine. We've done some preliminary tests on it, and it is radically faster than what the old system is. The tests that I did, don't get me wrong, are on strict HTML, but the one HTML page that I loaded on WP Engine loaded in, I think, 900 milliseconds, and on DreamHost, it was 2.8 milliseconds.
Right, so it's like three times faster.
Three times faster, which is crazy. And a lot of that 900 milliseconds was actually spent querying the DNS server on DreamHost.
So if it caches, it'd be even faster.
Right.
Is that right?
Yep.
Cool. Yeah, so this is a tough one. The problem with moving hosting providers is it always takes either your time or your money, you know, to pay someone to do it. And so you do have to get pushed to that point of feeling like it's all I can take and I can't stands no more, you know. That's definitely where we've gone. Hopefully, yeah, I don't know of like an absolute metric to say if someone goes down three times in 1 month, then you should leave. Because frankly, having been with several web hosts, I have probably six or seven different web hosting accounts and been with many of them for many years. Every once in a while, something bad will happen at a host. And, you know, they will go down a couple times in a month. And I always think, oh man, I'm totally going to leave. And then they won't go down for a year. And so it's worth staying, right? It's not worth jumping off the bus at the first sign of an outage. It's really a judgment call. And it's also a call of how well they respond. Do they follow these things? Do they keep you updated? Do they apologize? Do they credit you something? Are they a good host in general? And you do believe them that they actually are working to fix it.
Yeah. And what you said was dead on. I think it's how do they respond to it and how do they react? And like I said, I feel like we haven't done a very good job. You know, I've apologized to a few people and said, you know, look, we're really sorry. And, you know, posted in the forums and told everybody kind of what's going on. But I think that, you know, regardless of where you're at, there's probably always room for improvement. So maybe it's just me being hypercritical, but I think we can do better. Moving to a new host is a step in that direction, I think. So the last thing is that if you are going to go somewhere else, keep in mind that self-hosting is an option, but you are still tied to a co-location provider. And, you know, a lot of times managed hosting is a better option, but it's also more expensive. I mean, the fact is that if you're going to have to rely on someone for your hosting, good service costs money. But at the same time, you don't need to overpay for good service either. I mean, there's a lot of hosting providers out there that provide good service at a reasonable price point. One company that I remember, it was probably 12 years ago, and I forget what the name of the company was. It was down in Dallas, I believe. But they essentially had a setup where the co-location facility was on the border of two towns or two counties. So they had power connections from each of them. And pretty much everything was redundant. All their power, everything else, you know, their internet connections came in from both places. And they claimed the highest reliability that you could possibly get. Now, to host there was like $2,000 a month, and that was for one server, and I think it was a shared server at the time, but it was just crazy, crazy expensive. I don't think it was worth it, but I think that they wanted to portray that they were providing internet access, so they didn't want to provide the illusion, the perception that their site was going down because, oh, well, if they're a service provider and they can't keep their site up, then what does it say about them?
Right. And I think the thing to keep in mind if you are looking for a web host is that every web host is going to have horror stories. You search for Rackspace outages or Rackspace complaints. And since they're so big, there's just anytime they have an outage, they affect, you know, 1,000 people, even though that's like a bazillionth of a percent of the number of people they have hosted. So you can do the same with DreamHost and SoftLayer and MediaTemple. And you hear some people have terrible experiences with them and then other people swear by them. And I'm still, you know, at this point, having been with DreamHost for 7 years, yes, I'm miffed about their outages. But realistically, they actually have been a damn good host for the price that I pay. And so while we are going to get the Academy off and I'm going to get a couple other what I consider more mission critical sites off, I am going to leave several sites on there. I'll probably have 20 to 25 websites on there still. And I still will recommend it to some people. And I'll let them know, as always, that they are a lower cost provider and that they will have more outages than Rackspace. But Rackspace is like 4 or 5 times the cost. And so you have to weigh that out as you're looking. I think one other thing that is critically important, and I think it's something that we do have, especially, I know I have on pretty much all my sites, but especially we have with the Academy, is that having a good relationship with your customers is huge when you have an outage, because they give you some leeway, because they trust that you're not screwing them. And if you have just some business that's purely transactional, where they come and pay you money, they don't know who you are, you're anonymous, then when you have an outage, they're going to be pissed. Because you're a faceless corporation, so to speak. Whereas with the Academy, like, everyone knows Mike and I, and they know that we are, A, not doing it on purpose, that B, we're going to make it right, that C, we're doing the best we can, you know, all these things. And so having that good relationship with your customers really is that foundation of allowing them to trust you and allowing them to give you the benefit of the doubt when you do, in fact, have outages. And so, Mike, I think that's something, you know, we have with the Academy. We should definitely send out an email, like you said, to notify them. But it has been nice. We've been, you know, given the benefit of the doubt thus far. I actually had one question for you about this, because the original question was about Azure going down and about, you know, it made me think of like, huh, how would you handle that with Audit Shark? Like, do you have redundancy built in at this point? And I guess the answer would probably be no. You're still, you know, at an MVP stage. But had you thought about that long term, once you got, you know, some bigger clients using it, that you were going to build some type of crazy redundancy?
I don't know about crazy redundancy. I mean, right now there's a lot of things that it's more like everything's distributed.
It's a bunch of database inserts, right? And it's distributed to what? To multiple servers?
Well, what I have is, yeah, I have multiple servers in Azure. So what happens is I have two different servers in there right now. So if I grow the business and I need to scale out beyond two, I can scale to 3, 4, 5 or whatever. And because of the caching service that I'm using for the session data, basically it just scales all the customers across those servers. And I don't have to worry about that, because in building for Azure, you have a tendency to construct your application in such a way that it is scalable so that it can scale out instead of just scaling up. If I need to scale up, I can. I just throw in another, like an extra large instance, for example. Right now I'm on two extra small instances, but I could scale those up as needed. I think there's like 4 or 5 different levels. And if I get to the point where I'm on two extra large instances and it's still not cutting it because, you know, it's still just they're being overworked, I can basically add in a third one and a fourth one and a fifth one. And to the end customer, I don't need to make any changes because all of them resolve to the same URL. So all the customer installations go back to that same URL. What I would have a problem with is if the entire data center goes down. That's where I would have an issue. A lot of the things that happen at the customer sites, they are going to happen on a scheduled basis. So those things are essentially, they're caching their jobs and tasks already. So they're going to run them on whatever schedule they're supposed to run. And then right now, I'm basically just piping the data directly back, but the data is in the future going to be written to disk if for any reason it can't be sent up. Right now, it just kind of dumps it and redoes the work, which, you know, is not the greatest solution in the world, but it does work for the time being.
Yeah, that's nice. As long as it doesn't, yeah, it'll choke and somehow do bad stuff to their network or whatever. It's not like stuff so critical that it has to get done right that minute.
I'll be sending out emails and stuff like that on an ongoing basis for reporting and everything. But, you know, it has made me wonder a little bit, you know, what do I do if, for example, I'm trying to run a report or update some of the indexes in the databases to do lookups into the various Azure tables, because some of them are time sensitive. So what I've started doing is I've started restructuring my data a little bit so that if I need to identify data and what to do about the indexes or how to rebuild those pointers within the different Azure tables, because Azure tables are not like a SQL database. The Azure tables are more like a NoSQL database. So I have pointers all over the place that are just, you know, little snippets from in maybe 3 or 4 different tables that kind of slice and dice the data in different ways to make it easy to read. Well, what I've started doing is I've started taking those data and saying, okay, well, for my primary key for this particular table, I'm going to use the date. And then, you know, if I need to catch up on things, I basically just go back and look at a row that says, when was the last time that this calculated? And using that, calculate what the Azure table name is, and then go from there. You know, it's stuff that I've had to at least think about. But again, going back to your question about the redundancy, the systems themselves, I don't have to worry about it. If the entire North Dakota data center goes out, I'll have a problem.
Right. Yeah. And you would in any case. Let's just say there are more important clients than you right now using their North Dakota data center.
Right. I have thought a little bit about it, whether I would do an app one and app two and kind of cluster things in different data centers or whatever. But, you know, realistically, Azure only has 2 in the United States.
Realistically, like tracking apps like what you have and what Hittail is, where you just get a ton of inserts all the time, those are different than just having a web app, a transactional web app where someone's building a like an invoicing SaaS app or time tracking or something. The load is much less heavy, and if it does go down, you can let people know about it. Whereas like if Hittail were to go down and I was using the old synchronous JavaScript code, people had tracking code on their site, it would actually slow their website down. you know, it doesn't do that anymore. It's all asynchronous. Since I bought it, I rewrote it as asynchronous. So now if someone's web page loads, even if our server is down, their page still loads as quickly. And I think that's all you have to think about, you know, on your end, is that if your servers go down, does your client software that's installed out at the customer's area, you know, does that fail gracefully and doesn't impact your client's kind of workflow and network and all that stuff?
Yeah, and that's one of those things where you kind of need to rely on some sort of a caching service. And one of our Academy members, Jason Short, he owned VistaDB for a while and ended up going over to Microsoft to work in their SQL Server group. He sent a link out about a Microsoft research talk that he gave. And I looked at it the other day. He talks, the talk is all about doing things on the Windows phone and different types of database access that you can use and how to access things over the network and different caching mechanisms that you can use. And as I'm sitting there watching this talk that he's given, it just struck me that there are so many of these things that apply to like a distributed model where you have your software out there and there's different components where you may need to rely on external data. And he talked a lot about caching, how the fact is that, you know, just like a 32K access can create an extra 3 seconds of load time on a Windows phone. So, and again, some of these things are related directly to the Windows phone, but there were other things he talked about, like latency and going over like a 4G connection where the latency is, I think he said 3G actually, is 250 millisecond latency. But if you're doing, say, 10 data loads, I mean, that's, you're doing nothing but waiting for 2,500 milliseconds for data to come down. And on a phone, that's just a killer. But if you could cache some of that information instead on the machine, or you do it as a single query out to the data source, that you pull it down as one chunk and then you slice it up locally, or if you're just caching everything and then you go out and do like asynchronous data loads, those are the sort of things that are really going to help your application survive when things on the internet break.
I think that about wraps us up for today. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into us at 888-801-9690, or you can email it to us in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. A full transcript of this podcast is always available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.